For today's lecture, we'll be talking about the hierarchy problem. And the hierarchy problem is the following question. The hierarchy problem and naturalness. So the general idea between questions of hierarchies and naturalness is the following. I'm writing down a theory, and I have the naive expectation of what the parameters of the theory should be. For example, if you take the standard model and you measure the mass of the top, okay, say on top is 173 GeV. And then you know there are three copies of the up type family, three copies of quark families. So you know you have M charm and you also have M up. And then when you go to the lightest, you find that this guy is roughly 2 MeV. So this is the first type of hierarchy people realized, in a sense. This is the flavor hierarchy problem. Why are the masses of the three families so different? Okay. Now, now there is another hierarchy. We know that in principle, we can trust the standard model naively all the way to the Planck scale. But in the meantime, if you measure all the other mass scales, you find the mass of the Higgs and the wave of the Higgs to lie around 100 GeV. So this is a hierarchy of something like 17 orders of magnitude. Okay? Now, if you go to even lower scales and look at the universe, there is the cosmological constant scale, which is 122 orders of magnitude smaller than the Planck scale. So questions of naturalness and hierarchies have to do with these types of questions. Questions about, for the case of the Higgs, is a question about hierarchy of masses. For the case of flavor, it's about the values of the Yukawa couplings. Now, these two problems are actually not the same. And you can divide them up in problems that are technically natural and fine-tuned parameters. Now, the flavor problem falls in this category. It's a technically natural problem. Do you guys know why?
Because the masses receive small corrections, probably.
Exactly. So that's the point. So technically natural, technically natural questions of hierarchy tells you that, okay, I don't understand where the number is coming from, but once I set it in my theory, it won't receive any radiative corrections. And as we will see, this is exactly what happens for fermions. Okay? Now, if you look though at the Higgs mass, that's not the case. For the Higgs mass, then imagine you have a top loop, and then you see this is proportional top square. Okay? It tells you that, what does this tell you? Well, it tells you that you have a quadratically divergent quantity in your theory for the Higgs mass. Now, you can say, well, I can add counter terms and cancel it, so physically, what it means that if I have any degrees of freedom that couple to the Higgs, they will want to pull it up. So it's a question about the symmetries of it. So there is no symmetry that protects the Higgs. Okay. Question. There are other types of hierarchy problems. So if you write, for example, in the first lecture, we discussed the QCD angle that generates an electric dipole moment for the neutron. Okay. And turns out this parameter, if you fix the particle content, doesn't really get normalized. Okay. So, but if you have any source of new CP violation of the theory, it will shift. So in reality, depending on your theory, you can imagine it fits here or it fits here. And I was, as you will see later in Zhu's part of the class, if you treat it as a fine-tuning problem and you require that there is a dynamical solution, treating this as a fine-tuning problem tells you that there is a prediction that there is a new particle. Okay, so there is new dynamics that explains the value of this guy. Now, the cosmological constant problem. With cosmological constant, where do you think it fits?
Really fine tuned, right? Because I mean, the vacuum energy just like starts blowing up.
Exactly, it's exactly the vacuum energy. So the cosmological constant problem is a fine-tuning problem. Now, as I said, in principle, you can imagine you ignore these problems. How do you ignore them? Well, if I imagine that my theory contains a term that exactly cancels this, if I add it by hand, and I fix the Higgs mass to be a 125 GeV, I can still continue calculating every quantity in the standard model. You heard last, well, the standard model class, you talked a bit about precision and weak parameters, which depend on the mass of the Higgs. So if I assume it's fine-tuned, I can continue doing my calculation and the theory is fine. Is this satisfactory? No. In fact, in most examples of nature that we know of, naturalness is key. Take, for example, solids. Why is the Bohr radius what it is? Well, it's set by the electron mass, which, as we know, is protected by symmetries, as we'll discuss now, and the value of the fine structure constant. Okay? So in many examples that we have around us, naturalness, or the idea that value should take the expected, parameter should take the expected value, is a key principle for us to be able to make predictions in some cases. Okay? So, and in fact, people should take them seriously, and in fact, they have. Now, they put more attention, as you will see, to this problem than this problem. And it's not clear, it's not necessarily clear why. Okay? So let's go back now to understand better what this fine-tuning means, and let's go back to fermions. So we said that, let's talk about the electron mass, for example. Now, if I write a fermion, And as we discussed last time, the reducible representation of the Lorentz group for a fermion is a Weyl fermion. It's a two-component spinor. So you can write, if I have a fermion psi, the mass should be written like this. Okay. Now the question is there a symmetry that can allow me not to write that term? And if so, what?
There is like chiral symmetry, right?
Because, what is the chiral symmetry?
Yeah, because I can like rotate the psi bar in a different way than the psi, and then this term is not invariant.
Okay. This is Weyl fermion. So what I would do is take psi to e to the I alpha psi, right? And then you see this term is no longer invariant. That's exactly the chiral symmetry that you referred to. Okay? And it turns out that when I write radiative corrections to the electron mass, this chiral symmetry tells you that delta m should be proportional to m times alpha times log of the energy. Okay? So essentially, alpha and m here. So what you see is that, okay, I don't know exactly what that mass is, but whatever corrections I have are small and only have a very slow dependence on the energy. So let's go back, back even further, further back. Actually, right now we take this for granted, but back in the 1900s, okay, this symmetry was not apparent. We write this term like this now because we know about Lorentz invariants. Okay? Back then, back in the 1900s, people didn't know about Lorentz invariants. And they had the following problem. So the problem goes as follows. So I have an electron that gets accelerated, right? So if I have an electron that's accelerated, it means that because it has a charge, there is a time-varying field, so it should emit some power. Where is that power coming from? It's coming from the motion of the charge itself. So when you have moving charges, you should take into account that there is a back reaction force on the charge. This is what was known back then as the Abraham-Lorentz force, okay? And turns out that so people were like, okay, so when they tried to put that mass term in relativity, without having QED, what they found is that that force term was linearly divergent. It depended on what was the shape of the charge distribution of the electron. So another way to see this is that, well, if I have a charge, forget about the Abraham-Lorentz force, if I have a charge, then there should be an energy I carry around that should be proportional to alpha over the size of the charge. And if the charge is elementary, this is proportional, this is essentially equivalent to having a linear divergent contribution to your mass. And this was a big issue. In fact, if you didn't include the relativity and you were taking the back reaction of the force to the moving charge, if you had a non-relativistic motion, you would find weird things like exponentially growing velocity with time. You would find that the inertial mass, once you started try to include relativity, that the inertial mass wouldn't match the mass that you needed for this force to be there. And in fact, sometimes the Abraham-Lorentz force is also known as the Abraham-Lorentz-Dirac force. So Dirac, in 1938, wrote a paper where he tried to argue, okay, you need to renormalize the mass, so you need to add the counter term. So the question is, where does the quanta term come from? Turns out it comes from QED and the Lorentz invariance and the need, essentially, once you have these two things, you need to have a positron. So the positron, the reason that this mass is finite instead of logarithmic, linearly divergent, is because your theory automatically has positrons. And these are the ones that cancel the divergence of the mass. So this tells you that even historically, hierarchy problems are not necessarily just about aesthetics. They would give you inconsistencies in your theory. Okay? So the mystery for fermions was relatively, I guess, it took like the Dirac's paper on the topic was from 1938. So it wasn't solved right away. But once people started understanding QED and how Lorentz invariants work, everything became clear. So now the question is, what about the Higgs mass? Okay. Yeah?
Just before we move on,
yeah.
Did you conclude that the correction to the mass are proportional to the mass from the chiral symmetry?
So because you should have, so you can write a diagram, right? So I have the electron mass, if I write this diagrammatically, and I have an electron, I have a loop like that. That's the diagram that would normalize this.
Yeah, but it doesn't.
It's not divergent. This is before you normalize it, right?
It has to do with the chiral symmetry.
This has to do with the chiral symmetry because, so when you do this diagram, when you sum them properly, you need to take into account that in here you would have the electron, but you also have the positron going through the loop. So you have to do it properly, and it's actually quite a tricky calculation to do. I remember my advisor gave it to one of us as a graduate student problem, and it took a while to get everything to work out and isolate the part of the diagram that comes from the positron and the part of the diagram that comes from the electron. Yeah, it's not a trivial thing to do because now we are used to tools that automatically do this right away. And it doesn't show this thing manifestly. So we very quickly, once you impose Lorentz invariance and you have QED, then this automatically happens in a way. So I remember when I was preparing these lectures, I was trying to find if there is a good reference for you guys to see. But adding the positron Lorentz invariance, essentially when you have full QED, the mass of the electron is finite. And I haven't been able to find good notes on it. The only thing closest to that is the paper by Dirac from 1938. But it's impenetrable because of notation, historic reasons, and things like that. It's a very interesting thing. People don't think about. They think about these hierarchies as being problems of modern physics, but in reality, people have been worrying about hierarchies for hundreds of years. So, there is another one. What about, before we go to the Higgs mass, what about the photon mass? What protects the photon mass?
Yes, gauge
invariance, right? So now the question is, we have gauge invariance here. So now, let's write the Higgs mass. So in order for me to write, remember the Higgs has quantum numbers 1, 2, 1/2. So how would I write the mass for this guy? I mean,
okay.
Yeah?
So I just have a thought about this. So, mm-hmm. So this gauge invariance, right? We know that it's just like a redundancy in the description. So shouldn't one say that what protects the photon mass is that it has like helicity instead of spin or like or something like that?
No, I'm not so sure that's the right way to think about it.
Because if I give it mass, I would have like a discontinuous jump in the number of
Yeah,
moves I
but
could
even in
go.
that case, it's very interesting. See, the thing about the photon is that even in that case, even if I write, yes, in principle, you would be right. It's this kind of discontinuous. But there is a funny thing about photons. So, and this is something that people, so you write down your kinetic term, right? And then you write a mass. I think this has a minus sign, I may forget it now. So, and you write a mass that looks like this, okay? Turns out there is still a remnant of gauge symmetry even when I add a mass for this guy. So I can have, if I shift this, if I write this, the mass like this, where this is now the longitudinal mode of the photon, right? As you say, there is different counting of degrees of freedom because I have two helicities, and then when I have a mass, I have a third one. So if I isolate it and write it this way, and say that my symmetry now becomes a mu plus d mu, let's say alpha, then I shift phi and I take phi plus alpha, this is still invariant. And this is just a correction to the, then this term includes the kinetic term for phi. So secretly there is more symmetry for a U1, and in fact this is something that will come up in the next set of lectures. So if I write a mass for a U1 that's anomaly free, that's key, anomalies are very important here, then the mass, this is radiatively stable, this parameter here, because there is still a secretly a remnant of the gauge invariants. And people actually, part of the reason people talk about, if you hear about titles of particle physics talks, you will hear about, oh, I have a massive dark photon. And why do people talk about that? Because there is still a remnant. The gauge symmetry tells you that even if I write a mass and I have an anomaly free charge content, then this mass won't change, because there is still a remnant of that symmetry. There is still some symmetry that protects you, which is kind of neat. It's highly non-trivial. There is a very nice paper by Preskill. Forget, I think it's from the 90s, that discusses this. And discusses anomalies. But it is a good question. It is a bit of a discontinuous limit, and it's tricky. U1s in particular are very tricky. It's precisely for this reason. Yeah?
I just don't understand like how gauge invariants can protect anything if it's not as physical symmetry, right? So how can it like?
Because there is still a leftover symmetry, right? So you can think of this as the longitudinal mode of the Higgs that gives a mass to the photon. So there is still a remnant. This is still a symmetry, right?
So it's like is it a global symmetry?
I mean, it's a local, right? This is a function of a of x, but it's not the same as gauge invariants anymore. So you can, this is the funny, U1s are tricky, as I said, exactly because of this reason. So for example, if you throw things in a black hole, this symmetry is not preserved. And the hair of this guy would disappear. That's the other thing, because it's not a real symmetry anymore, but so it will disappear with a time scale set by the mass, the inverse mass of the guy.
But if I throw stuff in the black hole, I can still like measure the field that in the like,
yeah, the field will be decaying. So there's not going to be a conserved field anymore once the guy has a mass. And there are some papers on the topic, and I forget who wrote these papers. It's a very tricky thing. And it's extremely subtle. But the key point is to have anomaly-free theory. So if you forget about black holes for a second, The key point is to have a charge content that has no anomalies. Okay. So now going back to the Higgs. So the Higgs, the mass I write down is this, right? So now the question is, what symmetry can I impose and forbid this term? Before talking about Susie and things like that. What symmetry?
I mean, I could say that I want H to be equivalent to H plus some constant.
Exactly. So it's a shift symmetry. So if I take H to H plus a constant, the shift symmetry should forbid this term. Now this has other issues. Now if I have this symmetry, what is the Lagrangian a function of? If I have a shift symmetry, only the derivatives, right? So you have some Lagrangian that's only a function of the derivatives of the Higgs. So it's not a very interesting Lagrangian. I mean, you can write a higher derivative terms, but you cannot, most importantly, we cannot write Yukawas, and we need to write Yukawas, right? So in the standard model, the need to have Yukawas tells you the one naive symmetry you can write for the Higgs cannot be respected. And this is where the issue with these diagrams arises. So the whole game now is, what physics do I add to cancel this? And this is the game people have been playing for 40 years. Now, before going back and discuss a bit how this problem is addressed, we need to discuss the following thing. There is one more hierarchy problem, the cosmological constant problem. And as you said very correctly in the beginning, that the cosmological constant problem is just the sum of the zero-point energies of every degree of freedom you have in your theory. And then you find that this is a quadratically divergent quantity. Okay? Now, the smallest we can make it is putting the cutoff at the TeV scale. That's why in the beginning I was telling you, oh, if you put the cutoff at this TeV scale, it tells you that lambda mean predicted is roughly 10 to the minus 60, the Planck scale. Or it tells you that the universe can be at most a millimeter big, because the size of the universe, it says Hubble of the universe goes like lambda squared over M Planck. So if this is large, it tells you that the largest this is, the smaller the universe is. Okay? Now, people knew about these things, and they knew about these things the moment that basically they realized there is a problem with hierarchy of the Higgs. The same time they realized that there is a problem with cosmological constant. There is no symmetry in the standard model, Lagrangian, that will allow you to put this to zero. Okay? There is no symmetry at all. So people said, for some reason in the 70s, okay, if it's not infinite, it must be zero. What logic is that? I don't know. But they said, okay, it must be zero. So for a long time, and people continue to do that, for a long time, people will tell you, oh, the hierarchy problem is much more important, cosmological constant problem. I think it also, it's because it's related to the fact that you couple through it, to it through gravity. And because gravity is quantum gravity, so people thought about gravity is mysterious enough, so might as well add the cosmological constant to another one of gravity's mysteries. The problem is you cannot do that, because the problem appears, the universe, we know Hubble universe is 10 to the minus 33 eV. So somehow there is something that cancels this contribution to some very small value. So it's not necessarily a UV problem. It's something that you have to treat dynamically, okay? I highly recommend that you read, there is a paper by Steven Weinberg from 1988 that talks about the cosmological constant problem and enumerates all the ways the cosmological constant problem, the cosmological constant could have been zero, but it's not. Okay? One way people thought about solving it is the following. They said, okay, they said I have this constant to my standard model Lagrangian. There is this constant. And then I have some potential. Let's imagine that I have a potential for another field, let's say a dilaton. Okay? Any potential contributes to the cosmological constant. So they said, oh, let's imagine that I had this potential that magically adjusts the value of the cosmological constant to be really small. Yeah, exactly. So the problem was that, as Weinberg realized, is that if I want to minimize this value to something really small, I have to be close to the minimum of the potential. So if I impose that the minimum of the potential and the value where the potential is also close to zero are coincide for the same value of phi, it's another type of fine-tuning. And this is what is known as Weinberg's no-go about dynamical solutions for the cosmological constant. And it's spelled out in that paper. There is another reason why Weinberg wrote that paper, okay? And people say there are situations where nature does not there are situations where nature does not follow naturalness, okay? Now, let's take, in about a month's time, we'll have a total eclipse. I highly recommend. You have to drive 40 minutes east, and you'll be in the path of the total eclipse. Hopefully, the weather will cooperate. Why do we have a total eclipse? Because the shadow of the moon, the size of the moon, matches the size of the sun in the sky to within a percent. What dynamics impose that? Okay. There are, for example, I don't know if you remember from undergrad, you did any nuclear physics course. The binding energy of nuclear levels is characteristically of order an MeV, mega EV. Okay. Turns out, though, there are nuclei. In particular, there is thorium-232, 229, where there is an energy level splitting of about 7 eV. That's an accident of about 6 orders of magnitude, where electromagnetic contributions, because in large nuclei you have a lot of charges, and at the same time you have the nuclear force. So the combination of the two sometimes in that particular nucleus turns out the contributions to the energy level shifts are such that the two cancel within one part in 10 to the 6. Is there a reason for it? Nope. Let's take the Earth-Sun distance. Okay. The Earth-Sun distance, people now don't care much. Okay, it is what it is. It's one astronomical unit. We define a unit by it. But back in the day, when people thought that there was only one solar system, they felt, okay, we need to explain the size of planetary orbits. So people came up with theories to explain why the trajectory of Leplanos are what they are. Turns out that was again another historical accident. Well, we have about 10 to the 20 some solar systems in the universe. Whether the Earth is in the right conditions, not too far from the Sun to be too cold, not too close to be like Venus, super hot, and the right size to have to allow for life to develop, is just a historical accident. Astrophysicists call it the Goldilocks zone when they look for exoplanets. And this is basically, so we have historical accidents, and this is the source of anthropic reasoning. And this is where Weinberg comes in. So people said, so back then, so what about the cosmological constant? What if there is a way, and we'll come back later to the class in this, because it has inspired a certain type of model building. What if the cosmological constant is itself scanned in the grand theory of whatever we call the universe? Okay? How it's scanned, we can discuss later. And what Weinberg looked at, he says, okay, let's assume it's scanned. What would happen? He found out that by changing, when you change the value of the cosmological constant, if you make it larger in the absolute value, you will see that at some point it will dominate the expansion of the universe much earlier, so galaxies wouldn't form. This is what was known back then as the anthropic principle, and actually people thought that Weinberg was going mad because he predicted the value. If you calculate what the boundary of that value is, actually you find it to be, did I erase it? You find it to be pretty damn close to this. And this was in the 80s. People didn't know yet that there was a cosmological constant. People thought it was zero. So in fact, Weinberg, the reason he wrote that beautiful paper was, there's a couple of papers around that time, was to argue, well, if I do my reasoning and I find that the value of the cosmological constant is much different than this value, then anthropics it doesn't work. Okay? Fast forward in the 90s, we measured the cosmological constant and we found that Weinberg actually had made a prediction. So this is a big puzzle. So there is dynamics and there is historical accidents. And it looks like in nature, forgetting about the cosmological constant, both occur. So the question is, where does the Higgs fall? It's clear we need something for it. We may need a symmetry, we may need dynamics, we may need a historical accident. And because people, as I said, the magic of gravity blinded them to this huge hierarchy of scales that the cosmological constant told them about, they only focused, since in particle physics in the early 80s and forwards, they only focused on the hierarchy problem. So we'll enumerate all possible ways, dynamical ways, with which we can solve the hierarchy of the Higgs and explain what the weak scale is. Now, the first idea that people came up with was not Susie. The first idea was inspired by QCD itself. So remember the first lecture where we said that if I have a coupling, and x now is 4 pi, 16 pi squared over g squared, gauge coupling, if I write the one loop running equation, I find that this goes like where zero is some set energy minus 2. The beta function times t, where t, let's call it mu naught here, t is log of e over mu naught. Okay? And asymptotic freedom from QCD, what did it imply? It implied that this beta function had a negative sign. But it told you that if I have x and this is t, I have something that looks like this, and at some point you cross zero. So when x crosses zero in the IR, it means x hits a Landau pole. And this means that this coupling becomes strong. In terms of the value of the coupling at high energies, this new scale, lambda IR, can be written as lambda UV times e to the, I'm going to assume beta here is negative, okay? 8 pi squared 2 beta g squared, where beta now is the value of the coupling at the high scale. Sorry. The two should go. So this is what is known as dimensional transmutation. I have something that's UV free and it has a Landau pole. So if I put this at M Planck, if I have any coupling at M Planck that's less than one, automatically I can generate, and this beta is negative, I can generate a huge hierarchy of scales. A hierarchy of scales that is exponentially sensitive to parameters. Okay? So this is why it wasn't, this is what is known as dimensional transmutation. Okay? This is how asymptotic freedom essentially explain why QCD confines. And people said, okay, let's say that you have the way you have colored particles that are composite. Let's assume the Higgs is composite. And inspired by the movies of the time, they call the models, instead of having, they added a new color, they call it technicolor. So these are the technicolor theories. Told you the standard model is composite at the TeV scale or at the Higgs mass. So that's solution number one. And today, these theories, and I will discuss them later, go by the name of composite Higgs theories, because it turns out you've pushed the cutoff so much higher than the Higgs mass that the Higgs should be close to composite, but everything else, many of the particles of the standard model, better be almost elementary. So it starts becoming a bit of the versions of Technicolor that survive today are, I don't know how to describe them appropriately without offending anyone. So they are not the prettiest, okay? But people still consider them, okay? And so this is one. Now, the other one is, of course, that we've alluded to, supersymmetry, okay? And in supersymmetry, there, the diagrams that you have from the standard model, you have to add the partners of the standard model particles. For every fermion, there is a scalar. For every scalar, there is a fermion. Okay? And this automatically will give you something that's a correction, cancels the quadratic divergence that we saw before, and gives you a correction that's proportional to the mass of the heavy guy times some log. And now you see that the Higgs mass, in order to be natural, to be explained, you need to have the mass of the new guys coming at also at the TV. Okay? There are other ways you can play around. Theories of extra dimensions. Okay? These came much later than these two guys. Actually, these were already known in the early 80s. Theories of extra dimension tells you that, well, in fact, you have M Planck here, and the Higgs mass is here. But what if there is a way to bring M Planck at TeV, at the TeV scale? Then the cutoff of your theory is automatically at TeV, and everything is fine, because everything is the natural value that you expect it to be. And this happened when you include extra dimensions. Now, and then people started mixing things up. So in fact, the theory of extra dimensions, as we will discuss, depending on what the geometry of the extra dimensions is, can be related to Technicolor theories through, if the extra dimensions has an anti-de Sitter geometry, turns out through ADS-CFT, it can fit very well the picture of Technicolor theories in four dimensions. And we'll discuss this later. But nothing has been found. And this is for several reasons. And then people started thinking, okay, let's go back to the drawing board and see, we ignored the cosmological constant. So what if we were to include the cosmological constant in whatever we do? And then they came up with theories like split supersymmetry that preserve all the nice things that Suzy had and at the same time fit the philosophy that and philosophy that would explain why why the cosmological constant is small. Okay? So for the next few lectures, I won't talk about Technicolor theories, because these theories automatically, when you start making the particles composite, like in QCD, for example, we have the proton, we have the neutron, but we have all sorts of baryons, right? We have a tower of baryons. Similar in these theories, you would have a tower of composite particles that carry standard model charges that would couple to the Higgs and would mediate new sources of CP violations, so they would predict a large value of the electric dipole moment of the neutron. They will also mediate new flavor violation. So the kaon system would look completely different. So Technicolor theories quickly run out of steam because of precision measurements, even if colliders didn't have enough energy to probe them. In supersymmetry, you had similar problems, but the theory was weakly coupled. So you can do calculations and you can identify more easily the symmetries that would forbid these effects. And we will discuss these things later. So for the next one, we'll talk about supersymmetry and its particle spectrum and how these particles interact and what do you have to do to get supersymmetry at the TEV and what implications it has. Yes, you look confused.
Yeah. So if M plane was this low, then the string scale would be low, and then the winding modes would completely like destroy any EFT I would try to do, right?
So you would have it's like a strongly coupled theories. Yes. So you would have produced strings and people did have. There was a regime where you could probe the extra dimension and still don't have to talk about strings, but you would produce strings at the LHC. So you will have to look at the theory of quantum gravity at the LHC, which would be, to me, that could be the best scenario ever. Like if you had like a theory that tells you, I mean, we would have so much stuff to do because it's not that, first you start producing a few resonances, you have produced some black holes, but then you have you have all the modes. So it's really cool. Yeah, it is a strongly coupled theories.
Yeah, it's probably like the least conservative thing I've ever heard in physics, right? Like,
So people could still do calculations in some regime, okay? And there were some predictions. But you're right. It's a crazy thing. To me, that's my dream scenario. Like, if you were to turn on the LHC and start producing all sorts of quantum gravity states, then we'll be in business for hundreds of years. I mean, but it wasn't meant to be, though. And to me, it's more interesting even than, because you may also have Susie there, who knows what you have. Technicolor to me is the most boring one because it's very similar to QCD, even though the structure has to be different, but we've seen one of those already, in a way. Some other people may disagree. Yeah?
Okay, so in the Technicolor theory, it's like the new physics that kicks in at one TeV is like deconfinement? Or what is the new physics that kicks in?
Oh, yeah. So you have new states. So it depends on what the group and what the symmetry is. And people had different groups that UV completed to the standard model and different particle content. Now we're going to model building questions. So it depends on how you try to embed the standard model that preserves in low energies, whatever the confining theory does, should give you the gauge group of the standard model and the structure of the standard model and the UCAVAs of the standard model. For example, if you do chiral perturbation theory, when you do QCD, you see that the pion couples to nucleons. Similar, the Higgs should couple to quarks and leptons. Those days people were very good with group theory, much better than they are now. So that's it. Thank you, guys.